Hello, this is Ron Falk for the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, and welcome to the Chair's Corner. Today, we welcome Dr. Patty Chang, who is an associate professor of medicine in our Division of Cardiology. Dr. Chang has special expertise in heart failure and transplantation, and she directs the heart failure and transplantation program at UNC. She's also the program director for advanced heart failure and the Transplant Cardiology Fellowship, which is designed to teach trainees all about heart failure. So today, we're going to be discussing heart failure, latest research and treatment options, and some of Dr. Chang's work in this field. Welcome, Dr. Chang.
Thank you, Dr. Falk.
Help me understand what it is like to have heart failure if I'm a patient with it.
Heart failure is becoming increasingly common, and what we mostly see are patients with symptoms. And those who have symptoms are mostly a combination of shortness of breath or fluid retention or swelling. And if they're short of breath, they're usually not able to do what they used to do, so decreased exercise tolerance. And if they have fluid retention, like swelling, they often see it in their legs or feel like their belly's really bloated. Or sometimes their shortness of breath, and oftentimes is because there's fluid in the lungs.
So fluid in the lungs or swelling in other parts of the body, especially legs, can occur in liver disease. It can occur in kidney disease.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know it's heart failure?
It's a great question, because we don't always know that it's heart failure. And sometimes it takes a while to come up with the diagnosis. But the first thing one should think about is if their symptoms are not known to be anything else, or even if they have liver disease, it's probably worth making sure that their heart's in good shape. And a very simple test, like an ultrasound of the heart or the echocardiogram, can give a clue about the heart function. And when the heart function is reduced, we call that reduced ejection fraction or systolic dysfunction, that's often a sign that the symptoms are from heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
So what does ejection fraction mean?
The heart is a muscle that pumps blood to the rest of the body, and how much comes from the heart to the rest of the body is calculated as an ejection fraction, how much the heart ejects forward to the rest of the body. And a normal ejection fraction is over 50 or 55%. So anything less than 55% is considered low or reduced, and there's different severities among that.
So if I were a trained athlete, which I'm clearly not, what would my ejection fraction be if I were ready to go to the Olympics or have just come from it?
That's a great question, because there's a variety for athletic hearts too. But I think most athletes are at least above 50%, but some athletes are 70%, some athletes are 50%, but they should not be lower than 50%.
So if my ejection fraction is lower than 50% and I have shortness of breath and swelling in my ankles, I may have congestive heart failure.
Right. One should make sure you're checked out for that.
What causes congestive heart failure? Why would I get it?
There's so many different causes. It's not due to just one disease, but we often describe it as a syndrome that results from any disease that impairs the function of the heart. That's mostly a function of its ability to eject or contract or squeeze, as we often say. And so when it doesn't squeeze well or contract well, that ejection fraction is low. There's also a type of heart failure where the ejection fraction is normal or preserved, and that's called heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, previously known as diastolic heart failure. And often what's related to that is that the heart is so stiff, it doesn't relax well enough for the blood to go forward, and so the blood goes backwards. And so the etiologies for either of those are quite vast. The number one cause in the U.S. is coronary heart disease, or coronary artery disease, often from heart attacks or blockages in those coronary arteries. The second most common cause in the U.S. is probably high blood pressure. So treating high blood pressure adequately through the years is very important to prevent this heart failure syndrome.
And how about treating cholesterols?
Cholesterol contributes to coronary disease. for sure. Whether it contributes to heart failure is less clear.
And presumably I've already stopped smoking or never smoked in the first place, because that would contribute to coronary artery disease as well.
That's right. And so people who are at higher risk for heart failure are those who've had smoking, higher cholesterol, who have also had lower educational status or socioeconomic status, mostly because it's all related to coronary risk factors. But in addition, valvular heart disease, so if murmurs that go out of control or aren't fixed in a timely manner, if they become severe valve disease, they can lead to heart failure also.
One of the things that I've heard patients say is that they can't sleep flat anymore, that they have to sleep on multiple pillows, really are short of breath when they walk around. So when you see these people for the first time and you know their ejection fraction is abnormal or there's something else wrong with their ability to have forward blood flow, what's the first thing you're going to suggest?
Most likely, they have these symptoms because they are full of fluid in their lungs or have fluid in their lungs. And oftentimes, relieving that fluid with getting rid of it with diuretic medicine will do the trick.
Something like furosemide or
dumetamide,
one of those various.
That's right. And the most common diuretics are called loop diuretics, like furosemide, bumetanide, torsemide, or Lasix, Bumex, Demodex for the trade names.
And also some lifestyle modification to start with. It makes no sense to go eat a whole bag of salty potato chips when you're using a diuretic to try to get out salt and water.
That's right. In fact, the number one advice that we could give to really impact patient wellness is their own ability to control their symptoms by diet and exercise. We don't want them to be sedentary and become couch potatoes, but at the same time, we want them to be very cognizant about their sodium intake or salt intake and their water or fluid intake, because we live in North Carolina. Lots of people love sweet tea and barbecue, and that combination gets to be very difficult for the heart failure patient because they really can't drink all that much, and they cannot really eat that much salt.
After you've done lifestyle modification and put them on a diuretic, anything else one can do?
Absolutely. Our field in medicine in general has evolved so well to note that certain medicines are so helpful to either stop the progression of heart failure or maybe improve the heart function over time. And these medicines are various classes which block various hormones in the body, and they include beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, also known as angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors. A cousin of that is the angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. Also, another class is aldosterone blockers. And we have a brand new drug that's made the heart failure professional community very excited, and that just came out last year, which was a combination drug of an ARB with a neprilysin inhibitor. We call that ARNI for short, because you know cardiologists love abbreviations and acronyms. But that is a new drug that seems to be the biggest thing since aldosterone blockers in heart failure, and maybe yet another tool in our kit to say stop the heart failure from progressing and maybe improve survival.
What do you tell to patients who are on a number of medications? How do you have them remember what medicines to take when and to avoid some of the side effects that may be bothering them?
Yeah, very difficult and a good question, because it's not just the doctor that is involved. It's really a team of care providers, including the nurses that they interact with, pharmacists that work with us, and ultimately the family. We really want to encourage the patient and their social support to help them figure out how to take their medicines right. And when we teach them about the medicines, it's often about, well, this is for what? For your heart in general, or this is for your fluid management. And if we need to develop a schedule for you or use pill boxes to remember. So we try to educate them as much as possible about which medicines are for what, But in the end, it is a lot of medicines for patients to take, and it becomes a little difficult, and that's why sometimes getting their family member to help out helps as well.
So caregivers or family members in general are instrumental in making sure that these patients do well.
That's right. Caregivers are the key to success, and we've had lots of people at UNC, faculty at UNC, investigating this topic who I have collaborated with to show that family members and caregivers can really provide important support to improve outcomes.
You've done a lot of research in two general areas. One pertains to risk factors that are involved in developing congestive heart failure, and also in terms of how patients do long term. Let's start with the risk factor studies you've been doing. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. My focus in that area has particularly been in the atherosclerosis risk and community study, of which UNC is the coordinating center. This is a study that's been following residents in four different communities for over 30 years, including a site in North Carolina, Forsyth County. And we have seen various associations over the years. And these include, as we talked about before, hypertension. Even if you prevent a little bit of a drop in the systolic blood pressure, that will not only reduce your risk of coronary disease, but reduce the risk of heart failure. Or the converse, you increase the blood pressure more, the higher the risk for heart failure. We've seen various other associations of, say, lung function and maybe even orthostatic hypotension, which has been curious. We certainly know socioeconomic factors, especially low socioeconomic status, is associated with worse risk for heart failure.
And how about outcome? How do you tell somebody you're going to do really well or maybe you're not going to do well? What are the determinants there?
We just recently looked at factors of medication adherence, and that certainly makes a big difference too. And so as much as people can adhere to medications and see their care providers in the medical setting, that will help them a lot.
You also have studied a very special population of patients who develop heart failure, and those are individuals who are pregnant. So you get, in some patients, heart failure associated with pregnancy. How does that happen?
It's a very difficult situation and unfortunately relatively rare. That condition is called peripartum cardiomyopathy. And it's
around,
really
around pregnancy.
That's right. Peripartum being around the time of pregnancy. And we define that fairly strictly to say if they have no other cause for heart failure, it occurs in the last trimester of pregnancy or up to 5 or 6 months after delivering. And again, it's a diagnosis of exclusion with the hope that there wasn't something else causing their heart failure. And oftentimes it can be reversible with good medical therapy. And in some cases, it progresses very rapidly.
Does it result in early birth or otherwise altering the course of the pregnancy?
Sometimes it does if the mother is very symptomatic. And oftentimes it doesn't really affect the child so much unless there's an issue for requiring the child to be born earlier, but that's pretty uncommon.
What causes heart failure in an otherwise healthy young person?
Yeah, we don't really know. I think it's still to be determined, but there has been some research to suggest that maybe there is an abnormal form of a prolactin-related peptide in those who have this peripartum cardiomyopathy. And so it's still under investigation about how much we should pay attention to that potential pathophysiologic mechanism. But what we have observed otherwise is various clinical risk factors, such as a woman who is classically more multiparous or having had multiple pregnancies, maybe having more than one child or more multiple gestations. They often might be older and of African descent, and hypertension, either pre-existing or at the time of pregnancy.
Let me go to a different topic, because you take care of a lot of patients who need a heart transplant or who've had a heart transplant. Who ends up needing a heart transplant, and how well do people do after they've finally gotten one?
If we had donor hearts for everybody who needed a heart transplant, we could be doing transplants for 200,000 people a year.
In the United States.
But what the reality is it's about 2,000 lucky patients per year in the United States who get a heart transplant. And who ends up needing it are those who really have progression of heart failure and are considered good candidates for heart transplantation, which often means what makes them not a good candidate is usually things like being too old for a transplant, or alternatively having too many comorbidities that prevent having the heart transplant. And also it's very important that these patients have adequate social support so that they can survive well and happily after heart transplant. And for those lucky 2,000 per year in the United States who get it, generally they do very well and resume a normal life. Several of my favorite patients have become great spokespeople for heart transplantation in general by demonstrating what they can do after transplant. One has run several 5K races, climbed mountains in Canada, and was really a true role model for others having lost 100 pounds after heart transplant.
Inspirational.
And he sends us pictures every now and then to thank us, to thank really the greater communities for his great gift of life. We've also had a terrific spokesperson who was a nurse herself who ultimately had a heart transplant, and she's been a terrific spokeswoman for women with heart disease and therefore women who need heart transplant.
Some patients aren't lucky enough to get a heart transplant, and so they have an artificial heart. What's an artificial heart, and how well do those work?
Technology is really great. These artificial hearts are now called ventricular assist device, or left ventricular assist device, to really support the left ventricle or the left side of the pumping chamber of the heart. And these LVADs, which we like to abbreviate everything as I mentioned before, these LVADs really can sustain patients for years. And they are a sort of heart pump or heart bypass machine to allow the body to function relatively normally for as long as that machine works.
And how functional are those people?
These people are almost normal, except that they have some limitations. Because it's a heart pump that requires electricity, they will have a drive line that comes out of the body to connect them to a power source. So they can't go swimming, they can't take a bath, but they can certainly shower and walk along the beach and be careful with everything they do to make sure their drive line's nice and safe. But ultimately, they're doing everything that they want to do outside of the water as long as they're keeping their pump and drive line relatively safe. That includes running, that includes dancing, that includes doing whatever type of races they want to do, too.
A heart transplant, though, is a better long-term possibility for those who get a transplant and who are medically capable of getting one. Is that right, or is the technology so advanced that they're almost equal?
Well, we all have biases, and I will share with you that my bias is that still tissue is better than a machine. But ultimately, the machines are going to catch up. And at this point, we still think, many of us, that the heart transplant is better because it's more durable. But you trade one set of problems for another, and after heart transplant, there may be potential complications that the patient has to be vigilant about to prevent future complications or other problems related to transplant. But the machine, very simple. It's a machine. You don't have to take 20 pills in the first month after implantation, but the machine doesn't last forever. Eventually, we think these machines can last very, very long. We've heard of some of these LVADs supporting patients for 10 years or more. And when the driveline gets internalized and it's all inside the body like a pacemaker or defibrillator, maybe that's when they can really last just as long as a heart transplant.
Other than being present, other than being in the house, what specific advice would you give a caregiver?
I think caregivers can be really a representative for the patient to not only care for them and make sure they're doing well, but report for them, follow their symptoms, track their symptoms, help communicate with their medical care providers as needed, bring them to appointments, support them during these difficult times when the heart failure gets symptomatically worse or they're experiencing more complications from their heart failure.
How do you convince a caregiver to speak up at a doctor's appointment?
It's a great question because I think this is the art of medicine. And sometimes it's hard to, you get both scenarios where sometimes the caregiver doesn't say anything and other scenarios where the caregiver does all the talking. And so there's probably a happy medium between the two, ideally with the patient talking the most. And I think it's very important to recognize the caregiver in the room and say to the patient, may I ask your family member or support person here other questions? Or to chime in if they have any other thoughts?
I typically always want to talk to especially the spouse because usually a spouse will tell you far more of what's going on than patients do.
That's right. And especially patients who like to minimize their symptoms. And that's where we get into the most trouble, when the patients don't want to share how terribly they're doing, but the spouse or caregiver says, oh, well, that's not how it goes in our house.
Right. The truth eventually comes out.
That's right.
It's always better for the patient and for the caregiver.
Right.
Where would a patient get up-to-date, useful information? Are there organizations that you would point patients to?
Yes, absolutely. We're very lucky that there are a lot of professional organizations that support heart issues and cardiology in general, and then particularly heart failure patients. For example, there's the American Heart Association, which is probably the largest professional organization about heart issues. And the AHA has a very specific website that is directed to caregivers to provide them a support forum and to give them some useful tips about how to become a caregiver. There's also a similar society called the American College of Cardiology, which also would have similar resources. A specific professional organization would be the Heart Failure Society of America, and they really provide great resources, not just for the professionals like physicians and nurses and other caregivers in the medical setting, but particularly for the patient and their caregivers for specific lifestyle instructions and advice, some explanations about the medications they take. Really terrific resources there, and I encourage people to look there. And then finally, I think there has been a lot of interest among patients themselves to support each other. And we certainly know of smaller societies that are patient-focused, that are disease-specific. There's one called the Myocarditis Foundation. But then those who have LVADs, as an example, they have their own website and organization called mylvad.com. And there are support groups that are very active on Facebook and other social media to help support each other.
Lots of useful information out there. Dr. Chang, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.